So, this is the Padded Room Podcast. My name is Darian. If you were looking for, like, a quality horror podcast with insightful things and well-worded reviews and news and things like that, go ahead and go move on down the line there. That's what I like to think that I do, but it's not the actual product that gets turned out here on a regular basis. On the other hand, if you want to hear somebody talk about masturbation for an hour and a half, yeah, you're probably in the right neighborhood, because that's more my cup of tea there. What's going on, people? Another week is here. I'm back at you. How was your Christmas? Merry Christmas, by the way. Did I say that last week? I don't know if I did. But Merry Christmas. I hope everybody had a good Christmas. How was yours? Mine was all right. No major complaints. My six-month-old son, of course, cleaned house. You know, everybody comes from miles around with toys and clothes and everything. It all just goes straight to him. We don't get anything. We don't even shop for ourselves anymore. It's just the kid, and that's about it. But I suspect that's how it usually goes, you know, with a newborn baby, especially if it's your first baby, right? Goddamn babies. Popping up all over the place, these things. Ruining people's lives, I tell you. That's not true. I love that little squirt to death. And, yeah, man, he's going to be spoiled rotten. At least until we can squirt out a couple of brothers and sisters for him. Until then, it's pretty much the Deacon Show from here on out. You know, that's just how it's going to be. That's all right. That's what I was expecting. I was an only child also, for the most part. But, man, I'm not going to lie to you. I was spoiled rotten as a kid. But, you know, I think I turned out okay. Other than this whole sitting in my guest room talking to myself for 2 hours a week. Other than that, I think I'm doing okay. Other than that, you know, borderline schizophrenic, delusional kind of a thing that I do for 2 hours a week. Other than that, I think I'm doing okay. Speaking of delusional. Oh. So, Dale got me the PS4. Talked about that last week. Very nice of him. Get it all set up. Get it hooked up, ready to go. Comes with one free download. I downloaded Destiny. You've seen the commercials. I know you have. I know a lot of you people out there aren't gamers, but I'm telling you, this Destiny stuff is pretty good. I get it all downloaded, ready to go, build my character, start playing the goddamn thing, and then what happens? Somebody hacks into the fucking PlayStation Network? Are you serious? Somebody hacked into the I got like 2 hours of gameplay in, and then somebody hacked into the goddamn PlayStation Network, and I couldn't do a fucking thing for the rest of the weekend. Awesome. Thanks a lot, you dickholes. Why would you hack into the PlayStation Network? You think you're going to make money off of that? Somebody told me online that it was some group of assholes, the Lizard Squad. And I guess they shut down Xbox Live, too. I don't know. But, dude, why would you do that? Come on Christmas? No, but I guarantee you there is not a holiday in which more video games are being played than Christmas, and you just ruined it for everybody, you fucking assholes. Thanks a lot for that, lizard dicks. So, obviously, I couldn't play Destiny, so I went and picked up The Evil Within. Has anybody checked this out yet? I'm sure you've seen the commercials. This is a bad motherfucker right here. Very Resident Evil-esque, I would say. You know, a lot of atmosphere there. I do have a few problems with it, though. I'll be honest with you. I like it, but there are some issues. Number one, it's not fun, you know? It's just not a fun game to play. There's a lot of, you know, having to look for obscure items and put puzzles together and shit like that. That's not fun to me. You know what I mean? I want to blast stuff. I want to discharge a fully automatic weapon into a horde of oncoming zombies. That's more my style. This whole puzzle-solving riddle shit, that's kind of, you know, it's a good game. And if you're a horror fan, like I know you are, you're going to want to check it out because it's crazy atmospheric. And when I've been playing it like from midnight to 2 a.m. with the lights off and the surround sound kicked up. I don't want to say I've made a vagina out of myself, but I made a fucking vagina out of myself. It's very, from the horror aspect, it's pretty good. The other problem I have with it, and this may be a cultural thing, it's Japanese. You know what I mean? You know what that means. You know, there's some cultural differences there, obviously, but I think a lot of their stylings don't really translate well to American. Like, for example, like the main character in this game is a cop, and he's got this crazy wild long hair. Cops don't have crazy wild long hair. In anime they do. Thus, in The Evil Within, your cop has crazy wild long hair. You know, it's just little pet peeves like that to kind of throw me off about Japanese games. Other than that, it's a pretty good game. I'd recommend it. Just know that the fucking PlayStation Network may be hacked again by these lizard assholes. And if it does, you can still play The Evil Within without being online. But you can't play Destiny, which is the game that I really wanted to play all fucking weekend, but couldn't. Thanks a lot, dickholes. You know, so yeah, I got that going for me. What other horror games are out there on the PlayStation 4? What else do I need to invest in, is what I'm getting at. I saw Alien Isolation. That looks like another boring game. I mean, you know, Alien, very cool. Walking around the ship trying to solve puzzles and crap like that. Again, not that fun, really. Although I'll probably pick it up anyway because I am a bit of an Alien fanboy. So, you know, there's that. What else? Oh, The Last of Us. Jason Harrell hit me up earlier this week. He said I got to pick up The Last of Us. Some kind of a zombie apocalypse situation from what I understand. Everybody's raving about this fucking game. I'm obviously going to have to get it. Oh, excuse me. A little gassy. All right. Oh, there's another one for you. Am I turning you on, ladies? Oh, you're fucking silly. All right, enough about me and my horse shit and my video game issues. Let's, what do you want to do here? Some horror news? That's the only reason you tune into this podcast, for me to bring you horror news, probably. Which is fine, I understand that.
Horror news.
Yeah. Oh, let's see what we got going on in horror news. Don Coscarelli is already teasing Phantasm Ravager. Now, it's not really a commercial, but he does have a little video snippet up over at Bloody Disgusting if you want to check it out. It's basically him decorating a Christmas tree and talking to some other dude about Phantasm. And then there's little snippets of what may be to come. I don't know how I feel about this man, but I think there was some allusions in there as to a giant ball destroying a city. I don't know about that, man. Do we need Phantasm to go all kaiju on us? It doesn't really fit the style of the franchise, I don't think. You know what I mean? I mean, the whole the mythos of the tall man is that he shows up, jacks a bunch of dead bodies, scrunches them down into little monk guys, and thus he's building an army to conquer the world. He also has the balls that fly around and tear up anybody that gets in the way. Do we need a giant one that's going to ravage a city? I don't know, man. I'm going to reserve judgment on this, but if that's the direction we're going, I'm not as excited. I'm still going to check it out, but I'm not as excited as I would have been. I don't know. I don't know what I was expecting, really, but giant ball ravaging a city. That's what it looks like we're doing there. What else we got here? Details on the Walking Dead spinoff are up. Really, I think we're just setting ourselves up for another season of bummers, right? Just with different characters that are, you know, we're going to come to know and love, and they're going to eventually die by one, for one reason or another. So do we really need that? Do we need that in our lives, you know? I mean, do we not have our own people around us that we know and love and eventually lose? Do we have to involve ourselves in these fake people? I guess we do, right? This is a form of escapism. I just wish that there would be, you know, just a glimmer of sunshine in there, you know? It was actually looking that way, now that I think about it. It was actually looking that way for a good chunk of this this last half season, or whatever you call it, when they were talking about being able to reverse the zombie apocalypse and get things back to normal with Eugene. And then you find out he's full of shit, and we're right back to being fucked. Well, fucking fuck. What are you gonna do, man? Yeah, are you gonna do? I mean, really, you're just asking for it. If you start watching The Walking Dead and get all invested in it, you're just asking to have your heart broken and get kicked in the nuts, and possibly somebody spit in your face also, because you know what's gonna happen. You're gonna like all these people, and they're gonna get bumped off one by one, and they may even do so in gruesome and humiliating fashion. So there's that also. I don't know why I'm talking so much shit about The Walking Dead. I have a raging hard-on for Game of Thrones, and that's pretty much the exact same thing, except with dragons and shit like that, and, So there's that for you. Let me give you the details before I move on, since I just got done shitting all over it. The Walking Dead spinoff right now it's tentatively named Cobalt, and it's going to be set in Los Angeles. It's focusing on a divorced teacher and a guidance counselor with two kids. So that's probably going to be your core right there, your Rick and your Lori characters. Although I got to say, this does sound slightly more promising, because if it's set in Los Angeles, it's a much more urban area. So I feel like if they're doing it there, there's a good chance that we're going to get a double scoop of the walkers instead of more of this fucking who's banging who and who's in love with who and all that horse shit. So, I mean, I'm going to check it out anyway just to see what's going on. Hopefully it's not as big of a bummer. What else we got here? Teasers for the second season of Penny Dreadful are up on Shock Till You Drop. Did you watch the Penny Dreadful? It's a pretty good show. It's on Showtime. It's starring Josh Hartnett and Eva Green, whom you may remember from Dark Shadows and 300 Rise of an Empire. It's a pretty good show, dude. Check this out. It's set in Elizabethan London, I believe. And what you got is you got Frankenstein, Dorian Gray, the Wolfman, although you don't find that out till the end, Jack the Ripper. I think there's Dracula is like the main antagonist, but we haven't seen him just yet. You basically have like a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, but with all the universal monsters so far, and some extra ones, because you got Dorian Gray in there too. So that's pretty badass. I watched the first season, loved it. Pretty heavy on the sexy too, and plenty of naked Eva Green, which is something I've been wanting to see. So you got that going for you too, man. I'm telling you, it's pretty good stuff. Some heavy steampunk going on there too. So you got that. Good stuff, good show. The teasers for the second season are up at Shock Till You Drop. You can't really make out what the hell's going on there. There's like Eva Green and some snow and what's his name? Timothy Dalton's running around, and he looks all flustered. So you can't really, I can't really tell you anything more than that because that's all they're showing us. But I'm excited for that. It's on Showtime. Yeah, Penny Dreadful, Season 2. Check it out. What else we got here? Crave Online features a Woman in Black 2 motion comic. I went there. It's Crave. You can also find links to it at Bloody Disgusting and Shock Till You Drop. Basically, it's just a... do you know what a motion comic is? It's basically like a comic that you're going to watch on TV. You know what I mean? So it's like walking you through the different story panels and the dialogue and all that crap. And there's a voiceover that's kind of reading things to you. Basically, if you like the Woman in Black, you may want to check this out. It's like a little 2-3 minute snippet of how the actual woman, the human woman, became the Woman in Black. So that's fascinating stuff. I'm on the fence with the original Woman in Black. Oh, God, excuse me. I am gassy today. What's going on? I had Mexican food for lunch. That's what it is. I saw the first Woman in Black. It was kind of boring, man. I'll be honest with you. A very slow burn. But, you know, just a little too much on the buildup and not enough payoff, if you ask me. I dug it. Just... you got to be ready to hang out for a while because they really do a good job of building up the atmosphere. It just takes them 3/4 of the movie. So you have that. I don't know how to feel about the second one. It looks good, though. From what I can tell, it's set in the same village, and it involves some kind of a World War II fucking fighter bomber guy. So I'll check that out. And Woman in Black. Check out the motion comic. It may pique your interest and make you want to watch the second one. That's all I'm going to say about that. Oh, what else we got here? Stills from Guillermo del Toro's Crimson Peak, featuring Jessica Chastain. Yeah, I mean, this looks like Guillermo del Toro getting back to his horror roots and what he does best. Now, if I am not mistaken, the last thing he brought us was Mama. That was him, right? Mama? And before that, it was Pacific Rim. So, Mama wasn't bad. Heavy on the ghost stuff and the haunted kids and all that crap. I honestly have never seen Pacific Rim. People keep telling me not to, so I probably won't. Although it does have Idris Elba in it, and I'm pretty fucking gay for that guy. But, I mean, if you think about, like, The Orphanage, Devil's Backbone, these are all Guillermo del Toro classics. And they all revolve around, you know, haunted house-type situations. So, I think this, from what it looks like, and I have no idea what the story's going to be, you can look at the stills on Bloody Disgusting. It looks like some kind of a haunted house thing. You got Jessica Chastain running around in a very dark, dilapidated building. So, that's probably where we're going with that, I would hope. I'll check it out one way or the other, you know. I like a haunted house movie, and I like a Guillermo del Toro haunted house movie. So, why would I not go and give it a shot? I don't know. I'm going to do it. Looks like that's all we got on the old horror news, my friends. How about some listener mail, then? Do-do-do-do-do. Hopefully, people told us what they got for Christmas. That'd be exciting. See who got the best Christmas presents? Wasn't me, I can tell you that. Oh, well, yeah, I guess it was probably. I got a PS4.
Listener mail.
Sure. Started off with the emails. Our main man in Tokyo, Japan is coming in. It's Kevin. Subject line, Happy Holidays. Hey, Happy Holidays to you too, Kevin. I wonder what Christmas is like in Japan. I actually did do one Christmas in Okinawa, Japan, and it didn't really feel like Christmas. It just kind of felt like a Saturday. But I imagine a lot of that had to do with me being on a Marine Corps base. So for that point, it probably was just a Saturday. Hey, Darian. Merry Christmas. Congrats on the new PS4. That is a pretty sweet gift. Thanks, Dr. Dale. Yeah, I told him thanks. For last week's immersion therapy, watched Oculus. Now, that was a pretty great film. Really suspenseful and scary scenes. But I could totally see what was going to happen with that anchor doohickey with the angle and position it ends in. She shouldn't have made it swing higher up so that it wasn't in harm of humans, just the top glass of the mirror. That would make perfect sense, Kevin. You know, if it just clipped the top, theoretically it should spiderweb the glass and thus destroy it, so that would have been a safer way to go. But, you know, those kind of oversights often happen in horror films. That's how we end up with dead bodies. Gotta love them. Onto the Terra Dome, Wolfman versus the Leprechaun. The Leprechaun does have the magic advantage. Vote goes to Leprechaun. Leprechaun is also your fighter, Kevin, so I guess that makes sense to you. Cenobites versus the Nightbreed. Agree with Darian. Cenobites have the upper hand. Vote goes to Cenobites. Beautiful. Kevin, or at Lonely Bob on Twitter. Thanks for writing in, Kev. Hope you had a Merry Christmas over there in Tokyo. I mean, I imagine, I think the national religion over there is Buddhism, but I know there are Christian churches, so, but they're really, really into their kids over there. Japanese love the shit out of their kids, for the most part. I bet they do Christmas up pretty good. So there's probably like a lot of Santa, I would imagine there's a lot of Santa stuff. That'd just be, I don't know. I can't say for sure. Kevin, let me know what Christmas is like over there. I'm curious now. Up next, Sean G coming in. Have you been to angrygnomecomics.com? That's where you want to go. I'm done telling you people this because I'm blue in the face with telling you about angrygnomecomics.com. Go to angrygnomecomics.com or actionlabcomics.com. That's where you can pre-order your Puppet Master comics that are going to be coming out in 2015. That Sean has been working very diligently on. You sons of bitches. Subject line, Terra Dome, Sean G. Okay, so I've been busting my ass on this comic. I'm working on what you may have heard of. It's called Puppet Master. I think we've heard of that, haven't we? That sounds familiar. Sure. Starting on the 1st of January, any comic shop should be able to pre-order issue number 1. So shit is getting real. Just go in and tell them you want the Puppet Master comic from Action Lab Danger Zone. Due to that, I haven't been able to write in, but I couldn't let the Nightbreed down in the Terra Dome. So here are my votes. Nightbreed over Cenobites. That one really I could see going either way, right? That's like a Clive Barker extravaganza. So, the breed has a numbers advantage, but then the Cenobites are demons, so unless one of the breed can figure out Lemur Shan's box, there's a good idea. I don't know. It could go either way, really. Leprechaun versus Wolfman is actually interesting. Does the Leprechaun get the Wolfman to wish away his curse, then kill him? Does the Wolfman's animal side keep him from processing the Leprechaun's promises and just slaughter the runt? I'll have to vote Leprechaun on this. I think his magic would be the tipping point. Fucking son of a bitch. We're going to do another round of Leprechaun? Is that what we're doing? Awesome. You sons of bitches. I think his magic would be the tipping point. Anyway, keep an eye peeled for the Puppet Master comic. I'll be bringing it up constantly, so bear with me. Sean. Sean, please do. I like to keep people abreast of the Puppet Master comics. So, yeah, let us know what's going on with that. That was it for the emails. Everybody's busy with the holidays. I get it. So, don't worry about getting back to me on this stuff. How about some voicemails? Looks like Big Al called in from Alabama twice, which means there's a good chance he probably got cut off. Fucking son of a K7 bitch. Here we go.
Love hearing Poe's Angry Johnny. Loved that song for a long time.
That's a good tune, huh?
Anyway, Terra Dome pick.
What you got?
I gotta go with the Leprechaun.
You motherfuckers.
I have not tried to fix the fight or promote.
Bullshit, Alan.
I don't really care if he wins. It's just who he's going up against.
You don't like the Wolfman.
I gotta go with the Leprechaun. And teams. Oh. The Breed versus the Cenobite.
It's a tough one, huh?
I'll come back to that one. I guess I'll just say.
All right.
Anyway, the reason I was in the woods doing jumping jacks, it wasn't because I was embarrassed.
Okay.
It was Monday. I needed to start. Needed to be in the woods on Monday. Me and one of my buddies were out there shooting, and he was fishing, and I stopped shooting, and was like, okay, I'll do the jumping jacks. Well, I started on them, but I like being in the woods. Anyway, back to teams, breed or Cenobite?
Tough one.
Oh, man. Cenobites.
Gotta go with the bites.
That's all I got. Y'all have a good one. Bye.
You too, Alan. Alan called back. Apparently, he's got more to get off his chest here. Do-do-do-do-do. Alan.
Padded room. What's up?
There he is.
I called twice.
You did.
A new issue of Revolver Metal Mag is out, and it's got some health and fitness tips and stuff from metal dudes and chicks.
Hope what do you got?
I might be interested in that. I don't know how many of my metalhead.
You are a metalhead.
But it looks pretty cool. I'm checking it out now. It's got a Boyle Wolfgang von Frankenstein from the Misfits and Gorgeous Frankenstein on the cover. And a smoking hot blue-haired chick.
I love a blue-haired chick.
Arch Enemy.
I don't know who that is.
Her name is Elisa White Glues or something.
Okay.
Smoking hot, but they're on the cover. And that's all I got. Bye.
Might have to pick that one up, dude. So there you have it. Pick up this month's issue of Revolver for some heavy metal fitness tips. Might have to check that one out. But I imagine it involves a lot of bench pressing amps, banging crack whores, and going on a strict bottle of Jack Daniels diet, I guess. I don't know. Maybe I stay away from that one after all. Probably I could see it doing some damage. That's all we got on the listener mail. Let me check the Twitter right quick. Looks like somebody came in here. Excuse me. Oh. Do-do-do-do-do. Hey, it's Gracie's Poppy. At Padded Room Pod, Terra Dome Picks. Wolfman has Lucky Charms for breakfast. Another one for the Wolfman. And the Nightbreed wins the Battle of the Berserkers. Another one for the Night Breed. Very cool, GP. Thanks for tweeting in, man. Alrighty, that was it for the listener mail. Let's go ahead and hop into a movie, shall we?
I am Dracula. A moment ago, I stumbled upon a most amazing phenomenon. Something so incredible, I mistrust my own judgment. Look.
Dracula. The very mention of the name brings to mind things so evil, so fantastic, so degrading. You wonder if it isn't all a dream, a nightmare.
Rats, thousands, millions of them.
But no, this is no dream. This is Dracula, the original terrifying story of a maniac and a man who lived after death, lived on human blood, took the form of a vampire bat, and lured innocent girls to a fate truly worse than death.
Dracula? Oh, what's he done to you, dear? Tell me.
He came to me. He opened a thing in his arm. And he made me drink.
Alrighty, we're talking about Dracula from 1931, starring Bela Lugosi, Helen Chandler, and David Manners. Very good stuff here, dudes. This one's directed by Todd Browning and Carl Freud, written, of course, by Bram Stoker. Now, we've talked about other versions of Dracula before. most notably the 1992 version, which I think is by and far the most superior. And I'm not just saying that because it's, you know, got all the special effects and the updated stuff and all that. But if you just think about the scope of the story, you know what I mean? It's a much deeper, in-depth look at these characters. Now, I get it. This one's made in 1931, and back then movies were limited to about an hour. So you can't squeeze a whole lot of the original Bram Stoker mythos into 1 hour, especially in 1931 when you have next to zero special effects and a studio that won't let you show boobs or anything, right? So, I mean, how are you going to work around that? It's kind of, you know, it's kind of like the after school program trying to put out a version of 50 Shades of Grey. Be a very short operation, that I can tell you. And I'm not talking about the main actor. All right, so this one differs considerably from the 1992 version, and if I'm not mistaken, from the original source material. Now, I have read the book, but it's been a long time. I think I was between the 5th and the 6th grade when I read the book, and I don't remember. I remember the bullet points of it just because I've seen the movie so many times, but as far as the minutiae of the plot goes, it's kind of, I don't know. But I know this is just a bare bones retelling of it. Our movie, this movie, starts with R.N. Renfield, played by Dwight Frye. He is on a stagecoach, and he is somewhere in the wilds of Transylvania. And he's sharing the coach with a few other people. They're making their way up through a mountainous area. And at one point, he says, "Hey, let's pick this up a little bit. I got to meet somebody at the Borgo Pass." As soon as he says that, the stagecoach pulls over, and they kind of let him out there. From there, he needs to find another mode of transportation to get to the Borgo Pass. He tells the people in the village he needs transportation up there. Nobody wants to take him up there. And then one guy, a heavyset dude with a wild mustache, is like, "You want to go to Borgo Pass?" And he's like, "Yeah, I do. I got to meet Count Dracula up there." He's like, "You're going to Castle Dracula? You're going to meet the Count Dracula?" And you can tell the dude's, in non-belief. He's freaking right out because this little schmuck is going up to meet the Count, and that's some scary shit. He gets some kind of transportation to the Borgo Pass, where he meets the Count's own stagecoach. Now, while Renfield is trying to get transportation to the pass, we cut to Castle Dracula itself. Now, here's the thing, but bear with me on this. And this, I think, is very, very cool, because you get a snapshot of the interior of the castle, and it looks fucking gnarly. We start down in the dungeon, where we see Bella coming out of the coffin for the first time, and he's got the pop collar and the big cloak and the slick back hair. Looking sharp, man. That Bella's a handsome devil, I tell you. We see that, and we see the underworkings of the castle, and it's just this dark, cavernous, dungeonous-like area. And then we see these three hotties pop up also. Little vampire vixens of his that he keeps around, like a harem or something. And it's that part right there, I think, is probably one of the creepier parts of the entire film. There is next to zero sound in this scene. At the very beginning, we get like a rat scurrying across one of the coffins. That's it. The rest of the scene is silent. We just see these three hotties kind of pop up out of the coffins. We just see Bella kind of come into frame, and then the camera zooms in on him. Dude, it's fucking sharp. I'm telling you. That is some sharp stuff. And I love the dungeon, setup down there, because it looks like it just goes on forever. I mean, there's like some archways and stuff, but it looks like a big open area, and that's exactly how I would picture like a basement area in a castle would look. So that's fucking creepy. Cut back to Renfield in the village. He manages to find his transportation to the Borgo Pass. Gets up there, meets the Count's coachman. Now, if you're paying attention, you'll notice that the coachman is actually Bela Lugosi. There's no allusion as to that actually being the Count, but it's clearly him, so there's that. He gets in the Count's coach. It's another very creepy scene there because, you know, Renfield, played by Dwight Frye, is actually a pretty happy-go-lucky kind of a guy. Businessman from London. He's there to do some dealings with the Count. Lease him Carfax Abbey, which is like a real estate deal. And he's pretty excited about this whole thing. I think it's going to make him pretty wealthy. So he's pretty happy to be there. He's all smiles, and then he gets to the Count's coach, and the coachman won't even talk to him. He just kind of motions him into the coach, and away they go. Now, this coach is hauling ass through these hills, and he's like skirting some cliffs and going up and down, and Renfield's getting his ass kicked in the back of this coach. At one point, he's like, "I say, driver," and he sticks his head out the window, and what we see is the two horses that are pulling the coach, and then a bat just kind of hovering above them, flying as they go. Now, of course, this is 1931 special effects, so you can tell, really, the bat is just, you know, affixed to a string, which is probably being held in place with a stick, and that's how it's going down. So they take this road up the Borgo Pass. They get to Castle Dracula. Coach comes to a stop. Renfield pops out. Coachman's gone. He's nowhere to be seen. Renfield's there all by himself. Okay. Now he's looking around at the castle grounds. This place is creepy as shit, man. Looks like nobody's lived here for a couple centuries. And I guess that would technically be accurate. He walks in. Dude, the interior of this castle is fucking gnarly. If we all just closed our eyes for a minute and imagined a long-abandoned Eastern European castle in the wilds of the Carpathian Forest, I think this is exactly what we would think of, even if we haven't seen this movie. He goes inside. It's just, I mean, you can tell it's like, you know, most of the backdrop is just an oil painting because that's how they did it back then. But it still looks fucking sharp, dude, I'm telling you. Big grandiose staircase, cobwebs everywhere, candelabras. It's like a fucking music video for The Cure, pretty much. You know what I'm saying? Bella comes, you know, sauntering down the stairs. He's got a candle. Now, if you're paying attention, there's something very tricky here that happens. There's a huge cobweb that goes across the first landing on the staircase. Bella comes all the way down the stairs, and that's where he welcomes Renfield, and we get the howling wolves in the background, and children of the night, and all that fun stuff. And then, you know, Renfield's looking around nervously, and he's like, this is where you fucking live, you lunatic? And eventually, Dracula's like, well, come upstairs. The castle is much more inviting up there. So, Bella goes walking up the stairs. Renfield's right behind him. Dracula gets like 3/4 of the way up the stairs, right? Renfield is coming up. He has to like use his umbrella to like get through a spider web, which means that since Bella was at the bottom of the stairs, he managed to walk right through it unimpeded and without disturbing the spider web at all. Which, you know, if you're paying attention, is kind of freaky. If you're not, then you're just like, it's a big fucking spider web. I don't know if that was intentional or not. You suppose they meant to do that, or if that was just a movie faux pas, or I don't know. Either way, it looks good because it kind of gives them an ethereal quality. Okay, so now we're upstairs, and Renfield is checked in for the night, and the Count is kind of pouring him some wine, and they're going over documents, and basically we get through this dialogue, we come to understand that Renfield is there because he is leasing a building in London to the Count. The name of the building, of course, is Carfax Abbey. I don't know what exactly this place is, other than a big ruined fucking house, I guess, or something. What is an abbey? Is that like a castle? Or a mansion? What do you do with an abbey? Downton Abbey? That's something, right? I don't know. Anyway, he's leasing this abbey in London, so that's good times. He signs the paperwork, he gets everything, you know, ready to go, and then the Count's like, "We shall leave tomorrow evening." And Renfield's like, "Oh, thank Christ, I gotta get the fuck out of here." The Count is like kind of turning down his bed covers, and he's like, I hope these accommodations will be pleasing for you tonight. That's my best Bela Lugosi impression, you bastards. So if you don't like it, just suck it. So that's everything's looking so far on the up and up. I mean, other than the place being fucking creepy. The Count excuses himself for the night. Renfield is kind of getting ready for bed. Now, in this is a huge bedroom area. It's got like a sitting area with a dining room table, and then it's got a huge fireplace and a big bed. And of course, it's covered in cobwebs and other dirty shit. At some point, the bedroom window comes open, and it's like a floor-to-ceiling window. And you can't really see what the hell's going on outside because it's all misty out there. But I think there's like trees and stuff, and there's like a little landing that you can walk out on. The window comes open, and Renfield, who's already rattled just because of the sheer creepiness of this place, is like, ah, fuck. He goes over there to close the window, and this giant bat, presumably the same bat that was guiding the horses up the Borgo Pass, comes swooping in. Renfield, being the happy-go-lucky, albeit slightly pussified dude that he is, sees the bat, puts his wrist to his forehead, and collapses. Because he's a man's man, all right? He's not taking any shit from that bat. Fuck that thing. As soon as he comes to. Ah, I love a coward. So he sees the bat. He passes out on the spot. Now, this is where things get pretty gnarly. And we don't really know. We kind of get some allusions as to what might, may or may not have happened. But basically what happens is the three vampire hotties come walking into the bedroom as Renfield is laying passed out on the floor. From there, the camera cuts to them. They're coming in. They're like in these nightgown things, which in 1931 kind of means like a full body sock, stocking thing. I don't know. They were still pretty hot, though. They come in and they just kind of surround Renfield. And then from the mist outside, the Count emerges and he starts walking in through the bedroom window. What the fuck happened there? I'm not 100% sure. I think that Renfield was somehow dominated because from there we cut to, you know, the Count and Renfield traveling, and Renfield has completely lost his fucking marbles at that point. So I don't know. I imagine they drank some blood from him and kind of put some nutty ideas in his head or something, because he's a nutbag after that. So cut to the next day, or a couple of days later, I guess. Renfield and the Count are now on a boat headed for London. We get a lot of, B-reel footage of boats splashing around in the ocean and stuff like that. It's pretty good stuff. Cut to the Count. He's in his coffin in the bowel of the ship. And Renfield is down there, and he's got these crazy wild eyes. And he's whispering to the coffin. And he's like, Master, we are almost there. And he kind of, you know, Dwight Fry, he played Fritz in Frankenstein. He kind of reprises the role a little bit because he gets real nutty with the Master and all that craziness. So it's, you know, a little bit of a crossover there, at least for him anyway. So, he's completely lost his shit at this point. From there, basically, we see a real quick snippet of a sun setting over the ocean, and then we cut back to Renfield and Dracula, and Renfield's like, Master, the sun has gone down for the evening. And then we see Bela pop out of the coffin. We see him make his way up to the deck of the ship, where there's a bunch of dudes, like, running around, massive crazy storm going on, and there's, you know, people in raincoats and stuff. And then we just see Bela kind of casually walk out onto the deck, cut to a couple of days later, I suppose, and the ship has docked safely in London. However, everybody on the ship is now dead. It's basically a ghost ship, except for Dracula and Renfield. Renfield is still in the bow of the ship with the coffins. And we get a very iconic scene there when they pop open the hull of the ship, because Renfield is just at the bottom of the stairs looking right up at the camera with these crazy wild eyes, and this absolute shit-eating grin on his face. And he's doing this really maniacal laugh. It's like, you think I'm kidding, but that's exactly what it sounds like, you motherfuckers. Quit making fun of me. God damn it, I'm trying to explain this. So that's what we have going on. Now they're safely in London. Renfield isn't necessarily blamed for the murders of the ship, the ship's crew, but he is put in a sanitarium anyway, just based on his nutty behavior. You know what I mean? I mean, the guy's acting like a nutsack. So now we have Dracula, who's there in London, and he's out wandering the streets on his own. The first snippet we get is him basically just walking down the street. There's some chick on the side of the road, and I think she's selling boutonnieres or something like that. She's got like little flowers, and she's trying to sell them to people as they walk by. She tries to sell one to Dracula. Dracula gives her like the crazy stink eye. You know what I mean? The Bela Lugosi stink eye. I don't know what you call that. He's got a crazy stare on him, that Bella. You know, he just stares at you with those eyes. And then she kind of goes catatonic, and then he goes into, basically he gives her a really slow hug, and then they kind of disappear behind like a pillar, and then you hear her scream. So we're led to believe at that point that he drank her blood, because from there we cut to him walking again, and then we cut back to her, and she's laying on the ground, and people are screaming, and there's a cop that's showing up there. So that's kind of like a dead body, right? I guess we have to assume that he killed her, drank her blood. So we cut back to Bella, who's just at this point kind of wandering the streets of London. He walks into an opera house, and he's very... If you've seen this movie, you know what Bela Lugosi looks like. He's, you know, with the tuxedo and the top hat and the big cloak with the pop collar. This dude is dressed to impress. And if I were him, I would not be fucking around an opera house. I'd probably be looking for a nightclub. I don't know if they had those in 1931. In London, I imagine they had something similar to one, right? Like a speakeasy or a bar. Probably had bars. I don't think they ever had prohibition in London. Anyway, goes to the opera house. He's walking around there, and he overhears a conversation from like a balcony seating area. And basically what the conversation is that Dr. Seward, who owns the sanitarium that Renfield is now in, is there with his daughter and her boyfriend and another chick. And they're, you know, talking and just having a good time. He overhears some of it. So he puts the Bela Lugosi stare on one of the ushers and has her go in and tell Dr. Seward that he has a phone call. So, as Dr. Seward's walking out, Dracula's walking in, and he's like, excuse me, I couldn't help but overhear your conversation. And then he basically introduces himself. He says that he just, you know, bought Carfax Abbey, which is right next to the sanitarium, and that they're now neighbors. From there, we get introductions all around. We find out that Dr. Seward's daughter is Mina Seward, which I don't think is the way that lined up in the book, but I could be wrong. Her friend, Lucy Westerner, is there with Dr. Seward, and then Mina's boyfriend, Jonathan Harker, is there. That's the people on the balcony. Dracula comes in, he makes his grandiose appearance, and he's explaining about the battlements of his castle in Transylvania and all that shit. You know, he's coming across a little creepy with the accent and the hand-kissing and stuff like that, but these chicks are just swooning over him. Lucy especially. Mina, not so much, because she's kind of there with her boyfriend, and I think she kind of got more of a creepy vibe from the old count. So that happens. from there, we cut back to Renfield in the sanitarium, and we get a little bit more of an insight into what's going on with Renfield. He has become obsessed with life. He wants, like, lives for some reason. Oh, God damn, Mexican food? Oh, there's another one. I'm going to have some editing to do. Who am I kidding? I never edit anything. He's become obsessed with lives, is what I'm getting at between burps here, ladies and gentlemen. He wants lives. He starts with flies, then he wants spiders, then he wants cats, and then he wants birds, and blah, 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 blah. Basically, what we're kind of piecing together through his shattered psyche and the different interactions between him and the guards is that the master, referring to Dracula, has promised him lives if he remains in service. Basically, what the master wants is Mina Seward. So I guess what he wants is Renfield to somehow help him put that together in one way or another. So how he's going to do that from a sanitarium, I have no idea. But we'll get more into that later. So that's kind of nutty. And then we cut to Dr. Seward, who is overseeing Renfield's case, and he's going over the facts and trying to, you know, put this whole thing together. Now, that night, we cut to Mina and Lucy in their bedroom, or somebody's bedroom, a bedroom. They're having a conversation about the count, and we get the snapshot just throughout their dialogue that Lucy is pretty fucking ready to... She's pretty moist for the old count there, kids. I don't know how else to put it, man. She wants to fuck this guy, and she wants to do it right now. That's really all there. Even in 1931 standards, I could tell you that's exactly what was going on in that conversation. Mina, on the other hand, is kind of making fun of him. She's like trying to do his accent. Oh, from the battlements of Transylvania and stuff like that. She's kind of, you know, he's all right looking, but I got a boyfriend and he's kind of creepy with all that Transylvania shit. So that's pretty much where we're at. That's what's going down. So from there, we get the count showing up at the sanitarium. Well, this part is kind of weird because I don't really understand what's going on with the geography of this. You're kind of led to believe that the sanitarium is affixed to Dr. Seward's house, or possibly Dr. Seward and his family live in the sanitarium. Because the thing is that Renfield gets out of his cell regularly and just kind of pops up in the girl's bedroom and in Dr. Seward's living room and stuff like that. So I'm guessing he was living there at the sanitarium. I guess that would make sense to me. I don't know if that's what's really going on. They're having this conversation. We get Dracula shows up outside. He dominates I guess it was a maid into letting him in. He gets in there and he gets to walking around the house. He sees Renfield. Every time Renfield sees Dracula, he immediately goes into this panic, fear-stricken, "Master, I didn't tell them anything, Master. Oh." Which I guess would make sense. He comes across Lucy. Now, Lucy is kind of in a trance-like state, and she basically kind of gets up and starts sleepwalking. He puts the Bela Lugosi stare on her pretty hard, and then she just kind of walks out to him, and then I don't know, man. I think that there may be, because, I mean, they go back into the bedroom, and then he kind of puts the weird claw, the claw hand on her. I don't know what that's, is that supposed to insinuate something? He makes like a claw hand and he just kind of points it at her. And then he kind of like goes in. I think there may have been some connotations that he was banging her. I could be wrong about that. I don't know. Maybe I'm just thinking with my boner again, but that's kind of the vibe that I got from the scene, because she's laying in bed. He pops up in the bedroom, puts the claw hand on her, and then that's it. That's the end of the scene. Cut to the next day, Lucy's dead, and Dr. Seward and now Professor Van Helsing has showed up, and they're performing a pseudo-autopsy-like situation on her. Okay, let's think about this for a minute, and let's just pretend that it's the year of our Lord, 1931. You want to insinuate that this count is attacking women in the boudoir. By that I mean in and of a sexual nature. How else could you possibly convey that without showing a set of tits or a boner or something like that, or some underwear hitting the floor or something like that. I don't know. I'll tell you what, my friends, 1992 version, old Gary Oldman put the dick on that chick, and he did it repeatedly, and she liked it. So that's all I'm saying. I don't remember exactly how it went on in the book, but I suspect there may have been some vampire penis being tossed around that place. That's all I'm saying. All right, so now Lucy Westerner is dead. Well, dead-ish, let's say. That's fucked up. We now have a dead body. Here's the problem. Dr. Seward can't find a cause of death other than a lack of blood. So he gets a blood sample. He calls his buddy Professor Van Helsing in. And they're going to run some tests on this thing. They put it like in a centrifuge and they mix it with wolfsbane or some crap. And basically, Professor Van Helsing lays out the fact that she was attacked by somebody that's undead. A vampire. She was the victim of a Nosferatu, so to speak. Okay, well, that puts a whole other paint job on things. Now, this part didn't make sense to me at all. Van Helsing shows up, and he's supposed to be the authority on occult lore, right? So, okay, he runs the weird blood test and concludes that she was attacked by a vampire. Now, what happens from there is that Lucy herself becomes a vampire, gets up and starts jacking kids throughout London. Now, that's just kind of like a B story, and we don't really get into that at all in this particular movie. Did he not know about that? Or because he didn't make any mention of it. They don't. I mean, there's like some newspaper clippings, and then we have like a dream sequence-esque thing between Mina and Lucy. Other than that, that's pretty much it for Lucy for the rest of the movie. Now, I would be of the assumption that, you know, Universal Studios circa 1931 just didn't want to get into a bunch of dead kids. So that's probably why they cut that out completely. That's just my opinion. Could be wrong. But it is alluded to that she did become a vampire and started jacking kids. All right, Lucy is now out of this equation. So from there, we cut back to the vampire, Count Dracula. Now, here's what's going on. Assuming that Dr. Seward is living in the sanitarium, Renfield cannot stay in his cell. And by that, I mean he just kind of comes and goes as he pleases. At one point, Dr. Seward is talking to Professor Van Helsing, and he makes the statement that Renfield sneaks out at night for 2 or 3 hours a night. Now, we know where he's going. He's going right to Carfax Abbey to hang with the master. But this is a sanitarium. Aren't you supposed to, like, lock these people up or something? What does he do? What does he have, a night job that he's got to go to? What's going on here, people? Get your fucking sanitarium act together, will you? All right, so I guess that's just how that works. I don't know. Okay, so now we're talking. Basically, what we're getting is Professor Van Helsing is kind of backtracking where the vampire attack may have started, where it came from, and who the attacking vampire is. Now, at this point, he doesn't know anything about Dracula at all. He starts questioning Renfield. Renfield comes down and he's like, you know, Dr. Seward is like, hey, this is Professor Van Helsing. We brought him in to help with your case. And, of course, Renfield immediately goes into this crap about the master and the master's coming and you got to get me out of here because the master's pissed off. At one point during this conversation, Professor Van Helsing whips out some wolfsbane, which apparently is some kind of a weed or a flower or something. It grows in Eastern Europe. And he kind of sticks it in Renfield's face, and Renfield freaks out. Oh, fuck. So, back to yourself, fuckface. Okay, now we know, the professor knows that Renfield knows more about this situation than he's letting on. All right, easy enough. So now we can start backtracking where Renfield came from to figure out where, you know, the vampirism is coming from. It's clearly not Renfield because he's out in the daylight and, you know, that's just how that goes. So he's obviously not a vampire, right? All right. So from there, we cut back to Mina. Now, Mina's having a pretty hard time dealing with Lucy's death to begin with. On top of that, she's now complaining about having strange dreams. I don't need to tell you what she's dreaming about. She's dreaming about vampire dick. Ah, you silly pervert. Well, that's true, man. She keeps saying that there's like a giant bat in her dream, and then it comes down and it like kisses her on the cheek, and it kind of hurts for a minute or something like that. And then she starts wearing scarves, and you can't really tell because it's black and white, but I get the idea that she was supposed to be getting more pallid in her complexion, and she's kind of more spacey now, and she doesn't really want to hang out with Jonathan anymore. That guy was kind of a stiff anyway. But she keeps having these crazy dreams, and she's not sleeping at night so much. She's sleeping a lot during the day, stuff like that. Dr. Seward, her father, is kind of freaking out about this because he thinks that whatever this vampirism thing is going around, maybe she caught it, or maybe the fucking guy is now harassing her somehow, something like that. So he calls Professor Van Helsing in to look at Lucy. They start talking. She's telling about the dream. She dreams about like a giant gray bat that comes into her bedroom window at night. Sometimes she dreams about a big gray wolf that comes out from underneath her bed. Stuff like that. It's run-of-the-mill vampire stuff. Very creepy. The professor is there, and he's like checking on her. He asks her to remove her scarf. And we don't actually see the puncture wounds, but it is mentioned that she has two puncture wounds on her jugular. Oh, there's another one. Do we have a running burp count for this episode? I think I'm up to about a baker's dozen. Excuse me. Okay, so she's clearly the victim of some kind of a vampire infatuation of some sort. Okay, that sucks. Literally. But the good news is that she's not dead, obviously, or undead at this point. And number two, we can probably, if we can find out who this motherfucker is, we can stop it. So that's the good news. In the midst of one of these little checkups that they're having, the Count Dracula actually shows up at the Seward house. He's shown in by the maid. He just walks right in. He's like, "Hey, Dr. Seward, I heard about Miss Westerner's death. I thought I'd stop by, see if there's anything I could do. I'm very sorry for your loss." And they're being very cordial while all this is going on. And he's telling, you could tell that the Count wanted to get in the pants of Mina, because he's like hovering around her and, "Oh, is there anything I could do for you? Can I be of service?" Things like that. You know what's going on there, Count Dracula. You're a fucking pee hound is what you are. So that's happening. As this conversation is happening, Jonathan Harker goes to a cigarette box on an end table. Now, as you lift the lid of this cigarette box, the inside of the lid is a mirror. Across from the end table, the Professor Van Helsing is sitting on a couch. Jonathan lifts the lid, and the angle of the mirror just happens to catch Count Dracula from where Professor Van Helsing is sitting. He's looking in the mirror. Sure as shit, this motherfucker is not casting a reflection in the mirror. Now we know who the goddamn vampire is, boys and girls. It's the goddamn Count that just moved in next door. The nerve of this cocksucker. Okay. Professor Van Helsing has to play this pretty smooth. So the Count's getting ready to leave, and the professor's like, "I think you may be of service before you go, if we could just trouble you real quick." And the Count's like, "Of course, I would be happy." So he comes back in, and the professor has the cigarette box, and he's like, "Could you just take a look at this?" And he goes to open the lid, and Count Dracula slaps the cigarette box out of his hands. Ka-kish! Very awkward there for a minute. What the hell just happened there? That's very weird. They kind of have like a little stare down, the professor and the Count, for a second. And it's very cool because you kind of get this feeling like, all right, you know, but now you know that I know that you know. And you know that I know that you know. You know what I mean? So that's how it's going down. And then the Count kind of excuses himself. He's like, "I'm sorry, I do not care for the image on the mirror," or something like that. And then he excuses himself. And on the way out, he's like, he turns to Professor Van Helsing, and he says something like, you are a wise man for only having lived one lifetime, or something like that. And then he walks out. Very creepy. But the game is officially afoot, motherfuckers, because now we know for sure. From there, Jonathan, it's weird because he comes in the front door, Count Dracula does, but then when he leaves, he just walks out onto the balcony. Jonathan Harker follows him out there, and he's like, "You just wait there a minute, mister." And then he's like, "What is that?" And obviously the count is gone, but he says that he sees a big gray wolf flying, running across the front lawn. Oh, fuck. Yeah. From there, Professor Van Helsing explains to Dr. Seward and Jonathan Harker what's going on. This guy is goddamn undead, you understand? He can change into a bat, he can change into a wolf, he can control animals. He's probably a couple hundred years old, he drinks blood, for Christ's sakes. This guy's an asshole, is what's happening. Your new neighbor is an asshole. That's the bottom line there, Doc. Figure that out. So they're like, oh, shit. Okay, so obviously he is a vampire, and he's fucking with Mina. He wants to probably make her his vampire mate or something like that. We got to nip this shit in the bud. And the good news, according to Professor Van Helsing, is that if we kill Dracula, then Mina will go back to normal and everything will be good to go. So that's the plan. We got to kill Dracula. That happens. I mean, that conversation happens. They kind of retire to start making plans on, like, some kind of a raid on the Carfax Abbey. As that's happening, Mina's upstairs asleep. The Count does his turn into a bat thing and swoop into her bedroom. Comes in there. Mina's asleep. She wakes up just as the Count's going in for a bite, so to speak, and screams. They come running up there. Mina takes off running, so Dr. Seward and Jonathan go chasing her, leaving Professor Van Helsing and the Count in the bedroom alone. And then we get another kind of a dialogue about, I know what you are, and I'm going to tear down Carfax Abbey brick by brick. I'm going to run a stake right through your goddamn heart. I'm paraphrasing, of course, and the Count is like, you should, now that you know what I am, you should go back to wherever you came from. You'll be safer there. And, you know, this is a little shit talking between them. Count gets away again. Okay, now we cut back to Mina. They get her, they round her up, they put her back in her bed for the night. Now we get a little kind of a visitation sort of a thing from Lucy. Lucy's up and she's a goddamn vampire now, and she's running around London jacking kids. But on this particular night, she decides to go back to the sanitarium there to see Mina. So they have a little, you don't get to see the conversation, you just get to hear about it the following morning, in which they're talking about she had another nightmare that Lucy was alive, but she's dead. I mean, she was up and running around, but she was still dead, and then she said that that Mina has to do whatever the Count says, and it's going to happen whether she wants it or not. So now we cut to the apex of this. Renfield gets out again. He's hauling ass straight to the Carfax Abbey. Professor Van Helsing and Dr. Seward and Jonathan Harker are following him because they know that he knows where the Count is. Now, we get inside the Abbey there, and it's pretty much the same as the inside of Castle Dracula. You know what I mean? Big, giant, sprawling mansion, castle-esque place. A lot of cobwebs, a lot of creepiness. They follow him in there. They happen upon a conversation. The Count now has Mina, and he's kind of abducted her. He's got her back to the Abbey there, and he's bringing her downstairs to put her in her coffin so that he can make her a vampire. Renfield is there walking into this situation, and he sees the Count, and he just immediately starts begging for his life. I didn't tell him anything. I don't know where they came from. And because now the three guys are outside banging on the door to get in to save Mina. Count's got Mina in his arms. He sets her down for a second, goes and choke slams Renfield. Renfield goes flying down the stairs. That's the end of him, I suppose. Grabs Lucy. Count grabs Lucy and hauls ass into what I guess was the basement of this place. Just as that's happening, the three guys manage to kick the door in and go chasing him into the basement. Now, this part I thought was pretty stupid. These guys are hot on the Count's heels. He just gets in his coffin and closes the lid. Mina doesn't make it to the coffin. She just kind of wanders off into the basement. So Dr. Seward and Jonathan Harker go taking off after her. While that's happening, Professor Van Helsing pops the lid on the coffin and puts a stake into Dracula, thus freeing Mina from the curse. And that's pretty much the end of the movie right there. Kind of anticlimactic, I thought. Good show. Not as good. I mean, for nostalgia's sake, you got to say it's a good show, right? But at the same time, there are better versions of Dracula. Bela Lugosi's a bad motherfucker. I don't think he was the best Dracula, though, dude. I got to tell you. I think Gary Oldman gets the Dracula Award in the opinion of this podcaster anyway. Either way, it's not a bad show. You've probably seen it. If you haven't, you definitely need to check it out. That was it for the Universal Horror Month here in the Padded Room. I hope you guys enjoyed it. We did Dracula, Creature from the Black Lagoon, Frankenstein, and the Wolfman. If I had to pick a favorite out of those four, I think I would probably go Dracula. I'd either go Dracula or Frankenstein. Dwight Fry's a bad motherfucker too, man. You can't sleep on that guy. I got a kill count of 5 on this. Let's see what we got here. popped collar. here's a funny little side story for you. When I was like, 22, 23 years old, I went into my parents' house wearing a douchebag popped collar. I walk in there and my dad says, "Son, come here, William. There are two people in the world that look good with a pop collar. Elvis and Dracula. You're not the king and you're not a vampire, so turn that goddamn thing down." I don't think truer words were ever spoke. I'm breaking up with you because I think I'm dead. Yeah, at one point Mina tries to kick Jonathan to the curb because she's clearly having some issues. Doesn't really fall for it, though. Just kind of, you know, makes him want to hang out with her more. Castle Dracula seen better days. Renfield saw a bat and passed out. Fucking pussy. Renfield loses his shit. Bella's got a pretty serious stare on him. Yeah. A lot of just close-ups of Bela Lugosi's eyes with the crazy eyebrows. Zero fangs in this movie, though. Not a single set of vampire teeth in this entire film. Van Helsing just wanted to look down Mina's shirt. Yeah, I could see that. Dracula's not a smoker, I guess. Mm-hmm. Very cool. That's all I got on Dracula, dudes. Let's take us a little break, and I'll get back to you with some more stuff, huh? Thank you. See what I did there? You were expecting some more horror punk, weren't you? Yes, you were. Don't fucking lie to me. I mixed it up. I like to keep it cultured here in the padded room. You know what I mean? I like to keep things fresh and innovative. Every time you think you got me figured out, I sneak in with some Tchaikovsky on you. That was Swan Lake, and you may have recognized that tune from the opening of 1931's Dracula. So suck on that. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's time to find ourselves a Padded Room Podcast Twitter follow of the week. obviously, anybody associated with this film is long dead, so how about, instead of that, we look at our immersion therapy, which was not a bad flick, called At the Devil's Door. That was brought to us by IFC Midnight, so why don't we see if IFC Midnight, IFC Mortgage Group, IFC Midnight has a Twitter feed. IFC Films. Yeah, I'll take it. IFC Films. IFC Films, you are the Padded Room Podcast Twitter follow of the week. How about a little Terradome action then, huh? Are getting down to the meat and potatoes in the 2014 Terradome Championship, my friends. Yes, sir, there are very few fighters remaining. We're about to crown a champion. First, last week's winners. In singles competition, we had the Wolfman versus the Leprechaun. And the story continues. The howling that haunted the Irish fields quickly turned to a pained yelping followed by dead silence. Francois came to Ireland in hopes of finding an end to his curse, and an end was what he found. The leprechaun ended the curse in Francois altogether. Francois shouldn't have gotten greedy. He should have just left the little man's gold where he found it. With a vote of 6-3, the leprechaun advances to the Asylum Conference Championship, you motherfuckers. We're really going to do this? We're going to have the Leprechaun in the Conference Championship? Fine. That's what you want to do? That's just fine. Fine with me. I don't make the rules around here. In teams competition, we had the Nightbreed versus the Cenobites. Story continues. The promise of new power was too great. Lylesburg couldn't take his eyes off the box or his mind off the secrets it contained. Upon opening it, the prophecy of Baphomet was fulfilled and Midian came undone at the hands of the Cenobites. With a vote of 5-4, the Cenobites advance over the Nightbreed. Holy crap, let's take a look at these matchups, shall we? The Asylum Conference Championships in singles competition is going to be Pyramid Head versus the Leprechaun. In teams competition, it's going to be the Cenobites versus the Birds. Stupid. That's kind of silly, man. I don't know about that shit. Let's take a look at this week's matchup. Now we're getting down to it, inmates. We are in the Inferno Conference, and these are our championship fights we are deciding this week. Here we go. As usual, inmates, bear with me. I am not a writer. Mina had been in desperate need of a summer job and a reason to get away. She'd found both in the form of a position at a local summer camp for at-risk youth. She needed the money to pay for her last semester at college, but more importantly, she needed to get away. Away from the city for a while. One of the professors from her night class had gotten a little too personal, and it was all happening too quickly. Professor Tepish had taught the evening class on early European folklore for decades without incident, but ever since Mina took his class, things had been different. He started showing up in her dreams and haunting her thoughts during even the waking hours. Now her grades were slipping and she was spending more time sleeping than studying. A summer job was exactly what she needed to get back on track. Camp Crystal Lake was in need of a makeover as well. In years past, it had seen more bloodshed than most battlefields. The legend of Mrs. Voorhees and her son continued to inspire copycat killers and unbalanced teens throughout the decades. In singles competition, we have Dracula versus Jason Voorhees for the Inferno Conference Championship. Winner of this will face the winner of Pyramid Head versus Leprechaun to become your 2014 singles competition Terradome champion, bitch. Yes! Back to these matchups. Dude, I gotta take... Here's the thing, man. I like me some Jason Voorhees, but I gotta go with Dracula on this, right? I'd like Jason. He's a killing machine. He's virtually unstoppable. Problem, he's basically an automaton, right? He does... He's a one-trick pony, pretty much. He just kills... And then somehow the kids manage to put him back in the lake at the end, and then that's it until the next sequel. I'm sorry, man. I like Jason, but I don't see how he gets around the just the cunning and the supernatural abilities of Dracula. I'm taking Dracula over Jason for the Inferno Conference Championship. Let's swing it over to the teams competition. We saw this one coming. My friends. Something had gone wrong. The xenomorphs were multiplying at a much faster rate than anticipated. The temple had been constructed to the tribe specifications, which had allowed room for 10 to 12 hosts. Hunter biotherm readouts showed closer to 25 gestating xenomorphs, which meant the humans had provided more sacrifices than necessary. Perhaps an attempt to impress the hunters and gain their favor. Regardless, the hunter team would have to touch down, make their way into the Hive Temple, retrieve the shoulder cannons before all 25 Xenos could breach their hosts. In order to survive the rite of passage, all three would have to survive the alien onslaught. Without their shoulder cannons, they had very little chance of killing all of the Xenomorphs. In teams competition, we knew it was coming. It was foretold at the beginning of the season. We have the Xenomorphs versus the Predators. This one is not nearly as easy for me to pick, be honest with you. I think I am going to have to take the Predators in this one. I'm basically basing that opinion on AVP, the movie, Alien versus Predators, which I believe the Predators did win. I know it left kind of open-ended, and I guess if you read the graphic novels, then it doesn't end well at all for anybody. But for that movie, and for my own personal opinions, I'm taking the Predators over the Xenomorphs. Those are your Terradome matchups for the week. In singles, we have Dracula versus Jason for the Inferno Conference Championship. In teams, we have the Xenomorphs versus the Predators, also for the Conference Championship. Get me your votes whenever you can, inmates. It's going to be the Mental Health Hotline, of course, is 206-309-9117. Or you can email me at thepaddedroom2011@hotmail.com. Or you can tweet them to me if you like, but you got to follow me first. @paddedroompod is the way to go there. Dude, it's about to go down in the Terradome, right? We're about to crown some championships very soon. Both of my fighters are still in it, so I'm psyched. I may just get to hold on to some of my shit this year. Some of it. You know what? I'm happy to send you guys prize packs, too, for participating in the Terradome. That's probably my favorite part of the show, is the Terradome. Yeah, so there's that. What do we got? What are you looking at? The fuck are you looking at, man? What do you mean, what am I looking at?
What are you looking at?
Just got a few things this week. I spent more time playing The Evil Within than anything else. Chasing the Devil from 2014. found footage exorcism thing. You know, it's nothing you haven't already seen, dude. You know, it's just that seems to be a trend that's going on right now is found footage exorcism. We just saw Inner Demons, which kind of equated it to drug addiction. We've seen The Last Exorcism, which actually wasn't bad. That one I watched last week, whatever the fuck that was. Arkham Sanitarium, you know, it just good. It, you know, it's cheap filmmaking. It can be done. It can be done well. This one, on the other hand, Chasing the Devil, not that good. Not that great at all. I mean, it's almost formulaic. Going into this, you know you're going to get certain scenes in a certain order, and they might throw some boobies in there, or they might not, or they might, kill a dog or something. They don't do any of that shit. Not that great, man. Chasing the Devil from 2014, I say give it a skip. Also from 2014, The Bunny Man Massacre. I wasn't aware of this, but our old friend Chris brought it to my attention. This is apparently a sequel to a different movie called Just the Bunny Man. Now, I went into this one thinking that this was going to be a take on the urban legend. You guys heard of this? The Bunny Man thing? Way I heard it, and none of this can be substantiated, but somewhere back east there is a bridge referred to as Bunny Man Bridge. And it's a haunted bridge. Apparently a lot of kids get killed there. It's kind of like a Lover's Lane type of situation. The urban legend states that sometime around turn of the century, an escaped mental patient got out and was basically roaming the woods there eating bunnies. Thus, they were trying to track him down and they kept finding dead rabbits. Thus, he got the name the Bunny Man. And then they built this bridge there and anybody, you know, he would show up and kill people that were hanging out around the bridge. Thus, we have the hauntings. Thus, we have the urban legend. None of that can be substantiated. This movie has absolutely nothing to do with that at all. So, we got that going for us. Basically, this is just the Chainsaw Massacre. If you remove Leatherface and put in a 90-pound guy in a bunny outfit. That's all it is. Not that great. It's actually pretty fucking silly, if you ask me. I'm not saying it's a bad movie. I'm saying it's a good show if you don't want to be scared, but you want to see some horrible acting and some ridiculous special effects and a not-too-involved storyline. That's probably a good way to go. If you have a thing for dudes in bunny outfits, this would be a good place for you, The Bunny Man Massacre. That's all I'm looking at this week. How about some immersion therapy then? Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Immersion therapy.
See, last week we watched At the Devil's Door from 2014. Not a bad show, man. It's from IFC Midnight. They usually put out pretty good work. This stuff here is pretty good, At the Devil's Door. Basically, you have a real estate agent who is trying to move a house in which some gnarly shit has gone down in. Now, you're thinking you're walking into a haunted house situation. Not to be, my friends. Takes a whole other turn on you. Since apparently I'm the only one that watched this, I'm not going to spoil it for you, other than to say it's a pretty good show. I think you'll dig it. Check that out if you get a chance. Or your immersion therapy for this week is going to be Mercy from 2014, starring Francis O'Connor and Joel Courtney, directed by Peter Cornwell. Looks like some kind of a devil-worshipping cult situation. I'm not sure what's going on there. But check that out if you can, and get with me here in a little while, and we'll compare notes. That being said, my friends, I think we're going to skip the Company of Wolves this week, because I'd like to, if I could, just waste a few more minutes of your time and address a few things that have been on my mind. This is going to be the last episode of the Padded Room Podcast for the year of our Lord 2014 Anno Domini. man, it's been a weird one, hasn't it? Jesus Christ. It's been a weird 3 years since I've been doing this show. You know, I was I've gone off on this rant before, and I just like to bullet point it for you one more time. There is something to this thing of ours, and by that I mean this podcast thing. I am not the voice that is coming out of your car speakers when you start the engine in the morning. You had to actually find me. You had to download me, and you have to take me with you throughout your day. I could be in your car, I could be at the gym, I could be in your cubicle at work, I could be in your earbuds on the bus. I am wherever you take me, and that is our relationship. There's something a little more intimate to that, I think, than just the terrestrial radio host. I could tell you what Adam Carolla's kids' names are. I could tell you about Joe Rogan catching his high school girlfriend cheating on him with his best friend parked in their car outside of his house. I could tell you about the time that Shane Diablo passed out on the sidewalk carrying his hi-hat waiting for the guys from Left 4 Dead to come pick him up to play drums on their record. These are intimate details of these people's lives that you wouldn't know if they were just your run-of-the-mill morning zoo shock jocks. So, what I'm getting at is that there's more to this than just the entertainment value. You guys know my son's name also. And you've been with me, some of you have been with me the entire time. The whole 3 years. Some of you even go back before the 3 years to when we really sucked in 2009. This year in particular has been a particularly crazy one. You guys have been with me through my wedding, the death of my dog, Calypso, Dale's, you know, the comings and goings of my meatbag friends and co-hosts here. We've seen people come into the fold and leave and then come back. We've seen Julie, remember her from 19 Nocturne? She had a segment on this show for a while. We also had Josh. You guys have watched, well, not watched, but you've been with me through the making of a couple of short films. And this year you were with me through the death of my best friend's son, Logan. That was tough action. And that speaks volumes to where this podcast thing of ours is as a medium. You were also here for the birth of my son, Deacon. It's been quite a journey through the last 3 years, and this last one in particular has been simultaneously nightmarish and ecstatic at the same time, for lack of a better term. So with that being said, this is going to be, we're about to close the visiting hours on 2014. I am going to take next week off. I'll be with you again on the 11th, I believe, of January. I got my fucking in-laws coming in next week. And you know what that means. They come in and they just throw their... Don't get me started. That's a whole other show right there. I'm going to be hitting you back in 2 weeks with some brand new shit, some new segments, some new people, new faces, new things. And we are going to continue this journey together, as we have for the last 3 years. Right after that show, when we had to discuss the death of Logan, I promised you I wasn't going anywhere. And I am holding true to that into the foreseeable future, come what may. Oh, geez, should I? Yeah, I guess I should. You know what? I'm going to edit that out. Before I close the visiting hours, I've got a whole crap ton of people that I need to thank for the last 3 years, starting with, of course, Multiple Mics, Nurse Nicole, and Dr. Dale. Without them, the Padded Room wouldn't be here, and unfortunately, they're not here anymore because they're just not. They have lives of their own, and that's understandable. Crackhouse Matt, who was with us in the early days when we sucked a bag of dicks. Crease, who's been with us since episode one of this incarnation of the Padded Room. Mike Cadaver, Shane Diablo, who've done quite a bit for us as far as getting us out there. Alan, Jesse, Irma Gersh, Ian, Onyx Hades, the rest of the RPN crew. Who else? Sean G at Angry Gnome Comics. Kevin in Tokyo, Japan. Gracie's Poppy, of course. Zach, Julie at 19 Nocturne. Josh at Beyond Horror and Final Equinox Productions. My wife Daly, my son Deacon, and anybody else whose name I don't know, I look forward to getting to know you guys as well in the coming years. That being said, my friends, I'm afraid visiting hours are over.
With the heat rise, I want.